Audi.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
You're listening to The Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca-Nand, and we're here to explore life stories through travel. On this week, we have a brilliant guest for you. She's written a book called The Salt Path. It's about a time where everything fell apart, and it's a story of hope and triumph over adversity and much more. In the same week bailiffs took away the family home, Raina Wynne and her husband, Moth, found out completely out of the blue that Moth had a terminal illness. Destitute and homeless, they set off to backpack along the windswept cliffs of the Southwest Coast Path that runs the length of the west coast of England, 630 miles of unforgiving terrain. With very little money for food and only a tent for shelter, they began to walk and walk and walk. This is their story.
I read your book, and your story is incredible. And I think what's even more incredible is that, just to set the scene, here we are sitting in central London, in the Strand, in the offices of Penguin, who have published your book. And just a few short years ago, you were kicked out and homeless and couldn't really see what was in your future. You must be feeling incredible, confused, strange right now. How are you feeling?
Confused would sum it up, really. It's been a roller coaster, from being at the very bottom in life to here, like you say, sitting on the Strand. It's been a strange journey.
And your book is wonderful. Let's start from the beginning. Tell me how you found yourself homeless, first of all.
Well, we didn't expect to become homeless, that's for sure. We were living in a property that we'd bought 20 years previously in Wales. We'd bought it as a ruin and restored it ourselves, completely with our own hands, sort of learning electrical wiring and everything else along the way. And our children had grown up there, so it was our family home. Not only that, we converted some buildings into holiday lets, which was our business, so our income. But along the way, we'd made an investment with a friend of my husband, Moth's, a lifelong friend. They'd grown up together. We'd invested in one of his businesses, which failed, and we found that, unbeknown to us, in the small print, we had become liable for debts, which we believed was untrue, but the court found otherwise. And so we were served with an eviction notice from our property, which they claimed as payment for liabilities that we felt weren't ours. We had just a week to leave our small farm, to pack everything up and get rid of everything and find somewhere to go, because we had nowhere to go, so we're facing homelessness. But during that week, while we were packing boxes, my husband had a hospital appointment with a consultant who we thought was going to tell us that a problem he'd had with his shoulder was just ligament damage, but he didn't. He sat on the corner of his desk and told us that my husband had a terminal disease, a neurodegenerative brain disease that had no treatment and no cure, and that there was nothing that he could do except say, here's a little bit of physiotherapy that might keep you moving for just a little bit longer. So not the best week of our lives.
You must have been in utter shock. You have lost your home, your house, the place you've worked and lived for 20 years and plunged all your money into it. And you've just been told that your husband has not got long to live.
That's it. Absolutely. We were shocked. We were stunned. Everything that we'd based our life on was gone. Everything that we were basing our future on was gone. My husband's future looked very, very limited, and what time we had left together seemed to be just a very quick decline. So, yeah, shocked, stunned.
In the early part of the book, you're hiding underneath the stairs when the bailiffs come round.
That's right. It was the day that the bailiffs were coming to change the locks on the door. We almost moved out, except for a few little things, but we weren't ready to go. We just weren't ready to make that last step over the threshold. And we were just sitting under the stairs, because it was a dark corner and they couldn't see us. We knew we'd got to go, but it was just that last moment. And then I saw a book in a packing case just in front of us, and it was a book written by somebody who'd walked the South West Coast path with his dog, a book I'd read decades previously. And just in that moment, it just seemed like the most reasonable thing to do, to fill a rucksack and go for a walk.
A few weeks later, you started that walk, and you walked and you walked and you walked, and it's an incredible story. Where should we start with the walk? Let's start at the beginning of the walk. You know, your husband isn't in very good health. Neither of you are fit because you've just been living normal lives rather than the lives of people that are hiking and walking and doing a huge amount of exercise. How were those first few days?
They were really hard. We weren't prepared for the carrying rucksacks up and down incredible terrain. The South West Coast Path is 630 miles of really difficult terrain. It has an ascent that's close to climbing Everest nearly four times. So that's a lot of up and down. And as you say, Moth wasn't well. So it was hard. Every day was hard. Just putting one foot in front of another was really difficult.
What kept you going?
Because there was nothing else. Because that's the thing that we had said that we would do, and we didn't know what else we would do. We were in a position of having nothing else to do. But also, there was a sense of that was like our last little moment of good health and time together, and it seemed like a really positive thing to do with that time.
So there'll be people who won't know what this coast looks like. Paint a picture of the coast on a good day, on a lovely day.
On a good day.
Yes.
Oh, right. Well, the path runs along a southwestern peninsula of England. It runs from Somerset through North Devon, the whole coastline of Cornwall through South Devon into Dorset. It's not a walk along a beach, that's for sure. It climbs up and down with the cliffs that face onto the Atlantic. It rises up cliffs that are 1,000 feet. It's not an easy path, but at the same time, it's a strip of wilderness that sits between the ordinary everyday life and the endless horizon of the sea. It's a line on a map, but it's much more than that. It's a wild haven of wildlife and weather and ancient battered landscape that can change your life in remarkable ways.
On a bad day, it can be very wild and terrifying. I know you encountered some particularly scary weather along the way. What was it like when you were sitting in the tent? There's just the two of you with a tiny piece of canvas between you and the elements. That must have been quite terrifying.
Absolutely. It was a journey of real contrasts in weather. When the weather changes for the worse there, it really does batter in. There was a point near Land's End where we'd walk towards Land's End in a horrendous storm of horizontal rain and like dermal abrasion of sand. It was a terrible day. We got to Land's End and there was not a soul there in what is quite a tourist hotspot. There wasn't a soul there. It was just rain and wind and weather. We walked beyond that built area, back into the blocky granite cliffs of the Land's End Peninsula, and it was just us alone at the edge of the Atlantic. And we put the tent up that night, and all we had were two sheets of wet nylon between us and Canada. But at that moment, we realised that by walking that walk, we were free in a way we'd never been before. We were free to carry on walking or not, or to give up or not, free to make choices that had we remained and fallen into the path of homelessness, we may not have had the freedom to make those choices.
And on the way, you encounter such characters, including some homeless people that are living in towns. How did they react to you? The hiking homeless, as you were, maybe.
The hiking homeless, yes. The homeless people that we met varied through so many different ways of living. The rural homeless tend to keep themselves hidden in a way that you maybe the urban homeless don't. So we came across communities of people living in horse boxes and sheds, but living together as a community. People who worked within the area but weren't able to afford rents, so they'd found another way of living. We also came across other communities of homeless people who lived in the woods, who camped in the woods and kept themselves incredibly private and very hidden. But equally, they went out and worked, many of them in rural jobs, in seasonal work that didn't allow them to find a rent because their income wasn't fixed. But also, I think we found incredible kindness from those homeless people, and they were prepared to help us even though they had nothing to help us with, and that was amazing. We never felt in any way frightened or under threat when we were camping wild in the rural areas that we were, but when odd occasion that we found ourselves caught in a town and having to spend our time there, then was the only time that I think we felt afraid. And it wasn't afraid of nature and afraid of what could happen when the tent blows away. It was afraid of our fellow human beings, which is a shame.
I imagine that when you're on that walk, it might be quite a lonely experience, but also an uplifting experience, that when you suddenly surrounded by people again, that must be quite a shock to the system.
That's right, it is, because you are so alone when you're walking. There was just the two of us, just walking for days and days, we might just see an odd person. But then when you're suddenly amongst people again, the unpredictability of people, I think, is the thing that makes you nervous.
I think people found you a curiosity as well, didn't they? I remember in the book, peppered throughout the book, you meet people that talk about you being the old people, but you're not old. You were 50 at the time.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at you sitting here now and also photos of you and your husband, you don't look like old people. I don't know what was... That must have been really annoying that they saw you as an old couple.
It was a surprise because I hadn't thought of myself as old.
Yeah, well, great, thanks.
But maybe we were a little bit older than the average person with a backpack, so maybe that's where it came from. But
some of the negative responses you talk about, although being called old is probably not great, but especially when you're not. But some other negative experiences that people, when you told them you were homeless, people visibly bristled and sort of backed away.
That's right. Early in the walk, we hadn't really thought of ourselves as homeless as such. It took a while for that to sort of register with us what that meant. So when people asked us, how come you've got so much time to walk so far, you know, so lucky, and we'd say, well, it's because we're homeless and we've lost our home, we've got nothing else to do, nowhere to go, and they would visibly take a step back or recoil their dog on a retractable lead or draw their children closer. It was a physical movement, which was a real surprise to us, because we'd been thinking we were the same, because to us we were the same people that we'd been when we lived in a house.
And
we
just a few weeks different. Ago you had a home and a business and a car.
Exactly.
And a life and a dog and
exactly.
Everything else that everyone else has with a hat.
Yes, ordinary life. I think the point of transition from one to the other for me happened when I was outside a shop. I was standing outside a shop doorway and I was counting some coins in my hand, trying to decide what we would buy with the few coins that we had left. And there was a Labrador dog tied to a rail outside the door of the shop next to me. And as I was counting the coins, a lady with a large white dog came around the corner of the shop. The dog, the white dog, leapt at the Labrador and spun me round, catching my rucksack. The coins flew out of my hand, precious coins. So I dived to the ground to catch the coins as they were rolling into the drainage gutter. So I was lying on the floor in the street with my hand down the drainage gutter, as you do every day. And the woman with the white dog started kicking me and saying, what are you doing lying on the floor? We don't have drunken tramps here. I couldn't get up for a moment. I was stunned by the fact that she was calling me a homeless tramp because I was lying on the floor, whereas only weeks before I would have been welcoming her into my holiday rental and life would have been very different. And in my head was the same. At that moment, my sense of self sort of started to disintegrate, because I realised that what I thought I was and what I now was a very different thing.
And let's just to be clear, you weren't playing at being homeless. You didn't have like a pot of money to fall back on or a house or anywhere else to stay. You had around £30 a week coming in to live on, sometimes less than that through forces that you couldn't control. You were really counting every single penny and going hungry as well.
Yes. We'd lost our home, lost our income, most of our possessions. We'd used all our savings on the court case, and we had a small amount of income a week of about £30. And that doesn't go far between two of you when the food that you're buying is on the South West Coast path in the holiday season when everything is ridiculously expensive. And it's also got to cover things like gas for your stove and batteries and ferry crossings, and it disappears very, very quickly. So we did spend large amounts of time eating super noodles.
I've done that myself, actually. Describe to me some of the characters you met. I know you met some wonderful, memorable characters as well. What was the one that, the person that made predictions about you, which were quite amusing?
Oh, early in the walk, we were passing through a wood and we were down-spirited at that point. We were, what are we doing? This is madness. And we saw someone up ahead of us who was seemed to be practicing yoga. Very strange. And a woodland setting. But we snuck past him and didn't disturb him and carried on. But then later, when we were just sitting, he came past us and he laid his hand on Moth's shoulder and said, "You'll walk many miles and you'll be well." And we were, "What? This is a little bit creepy." And then he just stopped and he said, "And you'll walk with a tortoise." And we thought, okay, this is an area of very odd people, and kept walking. But later on, we were in the last day of our walk, the very last day, and we dropped down into a little valley, and ahead of us we could see a man dressed in a sort of safari outfit, walking with what looked like a rope with a rock tied to at the end of it. And we're like, this is very strange, we'll have to go and investigate that. And we went down to find that this man was walking with a tortoise on a dog lead. Tortoise called Lettuce.
I think it's a good enough name for a tortoise.
As you do. So, obviously, some predictions do come true.
And he also said that you walked very far, and you did walk very far.
Yes.
One of the interesting things about Moth's health is at some point it starts to get better and better the more he walks, and suddenly you realise that actually he's not this person that's doubled over in pain. He's actually growing stronger and taller and fiercer as the journey goes on. What happened there, do you think?
That's right. He did struggle at the beginning of the walk. He was finding it very, very hard just to get out of the tent and put the rucksack on in the morning. And then we went through a really difficult spell where the drug he was taking for nerve pain, we ran out of, each thinking the other one had packed the extras. We hadn't. So we had a few days where he virtually went cold turkey from goes, which was really very difficult. But slowly, slowly after that, he started to improve. And we didn't really give it much thought other than he was walking a little easier, maybe getting out of the tent a little easier in the mornings. But we reached this cove called Porthelas Cove, which was a beautiful little bay against this. We arrived on a really still, warm evening where the sea was like syrup. And we swam in the water and the dolphins came into the bay. It was a perfect evening. We camped on the beach because it was too beautiful not to. Beautiful spot as the sun went down. Well away from the high tide line, or so we thought. 3 in the morning when I woke and I thought, I can hear water. And as I opened the tent flaps, the sea had risen above the shelf where we thought it would end, and was only a metre and a half, 2 metres away from the tent. So we shoved everything we could into the rucksacks, but grabbed the tent, fully erected, held it above our heads, still with the sleeping bags and lots of other things inside, sagging it down, and ran up the beach with the tent above our heads. And as Moth stood on the beach, holding the tent above his head, in a pair of underpants he'd been wearing for 5 days straight, I realised that he had actually run up the beach, holding that tent above his head, from the point at the start of the walk where he could barely put his coat on without help. He was now running up a beach. It was amazing. I was in awe. it was as good as it gets, because we had been told his health couldn't improve and he couldn't get any better. But he was doing. He was clearly stronger, clearly more lucid. Everything that we'd been told wouldn't happen was happening.
People fall homeless for many reasons, as you illustrate, but also there's problems with mental health and physical health. But do you think that process of walking, and I know since actually that you've unintentionally, since you started writing about it and released the book, that you've actually influenced other homeless people to get out there and start walking, which must be very healing for them in a way as well.
Well, I hope so, because we found, obviously, we were in a state of despair when we started that walk because of what we'd been through. But we found that although at the beginning we thought that we would just talk through everything and everything would work itself out in that way because we'd talk through it, we didn't. We barely talked about anything at all. And really, our focus became on putting one foot in front of the other, and each step we took became a reason to take the next. That strip of wild land became a reason in itself and a reason to go on. And as such, I think it allowed us to let go of the things that were causing us so much despair and anxiety, and allowed us to start to look forward to rebuilding our lives and rebuilding ourselves and our self-worth as well.
Almost like when you've hit rock bottom, you've lost your house, one of you has been told they're going to have a horrible illness, which will ultimately lead to death.
Exactly.
What else can go wrong?
And after we finished the path, I wrote, and after I'd written a book, actually, I wrote an article for Big Issue.
Which is a magazine, I should say, for our international listeners. It's a magazine that is sold by homeless people so they can get themselves an income. It's a great little magazine as well.
Yes, that's right. So a few months after the article for Big Issue came out, I was walking on the coastal path and I met someone coming the other way who wasn't an average hiker. He was covered in piercings, carrying some very strange equipment and a road worker's yellow jacket. And we stopped to chat, the usual, where are you going, where have you been? And he said 2 weeks previous, he'd been homeless on the streets of one of our cities. And he'd read an article in a Big Issue magazine about someone who'd been homeless and walked the coastal path. And so he thought, I can do this. And he'd filled his rucksack and started walking. And he said, it's the hardest thing I have ever done. But equally, I can feel myself changing already. And I know I'm not going back to my old life. That was, for me, a really magical moment. I was so happy to see him empowered by taking control of his own life.
But you didn't tell him it was you? Did you
I
tell
didn't,
him it was
you? No. I asked him to come back and have some food, but he said, no, I've got to carry on. I've got to find somewhere to put my tent. And he was on a mission.
I imagine that you wanted to take him in and feed him, because there's a good amount of people that you met along the way who were very good people and would say, have this, you know, here's a hot meal, here's a sandwich, you know, you don't have to pay for it. Describe to me some of those moments when people really helped you out.
It was really life-affirming. When you really need it most, for someone to offer you something, it means so much. Some people did just genuinely give us a sandwich or a bowl of soup. And when all you've eaten for 2 days is a bag of fudge, or 3 pieces out of a bag of fudge, it means more than you can possibly explain. But there was another sort of series of incidents that was quite strange, because unbeknown to us, at the time we were walking along the coastal path, a quite famous poet called Simon Armitage was also walking the path. For him, he was giving readings of his poems in return for accommodation and meals. And he was being a wandering troubadour. But everyone knew that he was coming. But throughout the first half of our walk, he was a few days behind us most of the time. So when we arrived in a few places, they thought, simply because we were backpacking along the same route, that we were in fact Simon Armitage. We didn't know who he was, having never heard of him at all. So we just went along with it when people said, well, Simon, have a sandwich. Well, okay, thank you very much.
Whoever Simon is, I'm going to take the sandwich.
I'll take the sandwich. We were even invited back to someone's house. Come and stay at our house. Come and camp in our garden. We've got a huge lasagna. So okay, Simon and myself went back to the house.
But you had no idea about this Simon. You knew in retrospect that this Simon Armitage was walking the coast. But at the time you had no idea, thinking, well, who the hell's Simon? That must have been really confusing.
We had no idea. But when we tried to get people to explain to us who Simon was, they said, ha-ha, you're such a funny man, Simon, just pretending to be someone else. So we just took the lasagna and walked on.
There's another time that you get stoned in a group of backpackers. That sounded brilliant. That sounded stoned. Like just the respite you needed.
Herbal remedies,
that's it, yeah. Useful herbal remedies, especially when you're not very well and in pain, you know.
That's right. I mean, it's excellent night with the, they were the surfers who lived the horse boxes and the sheds. They were very wary of us to start with, not one of their group, just drifted in from outside.
But old compared to them.
Old, much older, much, much older. But then they became a little more forthcoming when they realised that we were in a really, you know, we had no home and we were just drifting along. I think they thought we were more one of them.
There's another lovely point in the book where I think it's when you see Plymouth, when you look out and you see the ferry that you had once taken in what must have seemed like a lifetime ago. Yes. When your kids were young and you went on a family holiday. Did you travel much before the great walk of your life?
We travelled a little. We travelled around Europe in our little van for a while when the children were tiny, but nothing major. But when we were camping near Plymouth, we saw the ferry leave. And I knew it was the Santander ferry, having caught it before. It's a huge ferry, it's unmistakable. And it was reminiscent of our old life, of a life when things had been simple and easy and we'd gone on family holidays. And it felt as if we were at that point, at that cusp, where our life had changed irrevocably. We watched that huge ferry head out across the channel and it was like watching our old life sail away. All we could do was pack our rucksacks, face west and walk into our new lives.
At this time your kids are in their early 20s and they've moved out of home, thankfully. What are they thinking about everything that's going on?
Well, it was very hard for them. They were both in the last year of uni. We'd lost that security for them of being able to come home after uni when they'd got nothing. They had to go forwards and find themselves immediately accommodation and income, and there was no gap year. And it was really hard for them because they'd lost their family home, they'd lost everything that they knew that home represented. So it was very difficult. My daughter was very, very practical and, you know, like, here's a new phone, keep it charged, ring me every day. My son was like, oh, that's really cool. Yeah, okay, call me when you're back. Very different characters. But I think it changed our relationship as parent and child as well, because even though your children are in their early 20s, you're still that sort of protecting hand, and they're always your children, whether they're toddlers or whether they're grown. You always feel that as a parent, that's what you are. As a mother, I think it made me really aware of how much the family home is part of being a mother, what protection for them means. So when you take that away, then you have to completely reevaluate what that parent-child relationship is and how it's going to work going forwards. I think for us, it became more of a friendship between us, and we all became friends in a bit of a pickle together and stronger for it in the end.
What are things like now? Are you out of the pickle? I know towards the end of the book, I don't want to give away, I'm not giving away so much because I want to urge you all to go out and buy the book, but you're okay, you're sitting here now, you're not homeless, I'm assuming, you've got a book out. How did the book come about and what has sort of happened since?
We have found a place to rent and we now live where the coast path passes the front door. So we walk on the coast path every day. Moth went to uni to study for a degree in horticulture and garden landscape design, which he's just finished. So at his age, he has finally just left uni. A couple of years after we'd finished our walk, I was still acutely aware of how much that walk had given to me, how much I'd taken from it, and how it had changed my life. I wanted to start to write that down so that I didn't forget it. And so when Moth's illness progressed, I could have a way of him not forgetting it too. So I started to write it down. And when I started to write it, it came back so clearly, so as if it'd been the day before. And I started writing and I couldn't stop. And within 5 months, I got the first draft down and it went from there.
It's hard to get a book published.
Yes, so it's a surprise to be sitting here today. It really is. I think I've been very, very lucky.
So here you are, a book out. What are the next plans?
Well, as I say, Moth's just finished his degree.
How's his health?
He's not as well as he was when he finished the path, but he's a lot healthier than the consultants and the scans and everything else say that he should be. So in some strange way, his brain is finding a way to work around the bits that are basically shutting down. For now, that's where we are. And so I'm just grateful for that.
I know throughout the book, you're kind of, when he starts to get better, you're kind of rooting him. You're thinking, well, maybe it was a misdiagnosis. You know, you're kind of waiting for that sort of punchline, that twist that actually, unfortunately, never came. But luckily, he's in better health than you anticipated.
Yes, he is. I mean, we were told at the start of our walk that we'd be lucky if we had 2 years ahead. But that's been a few years now. And we just keep walking and he keeps himself mentally and physically as active as he can. So far, it's working for us.
I can see the film coming out of this book. Are you in talks with anyone yet?
Well, has been some interest, so fingers crossed.
It'd be amazing. I'm thinking Meryl Streep maybe for you. What do you reckon?
Do you think a few people have said that?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was holding out for Kate Winslet, but I can go for Meryl.
Either or, really. Yeah. I think it'll be fine. So you've managed to bounce back from it incredibly. What would you say to someone who finds themselves in a position like that, where they've lost everything?
I think everybody's different and everyone's reaction is different. But how it worked for us was by finding something positive to take us forward, to actually focus our thinking on something that would move us forward physically and mentally. And what we found walking gave us was the space to do that. It gave us space and an incredible landscape in which to try to find a way of rebuilding ourselves.
When you look back on that time, that immensely changing time in your life, what is the most memorable moment that really stands out?
We were walking along one day and it was a sort of wet, damp, drizzly day, and we saw two old gentlemen walking up the path towards us. One of them was bundled up in hat and coat. The other one was wearing his bathers and flip-flops, obviously been for a swim. And as they got closer, I could see he was carrying a Tupperware box. And he was saying, oh, what a beautiful day, beautiful Cornish weather. And offered me the Tupperware box. Said, would you like a blackberry? It was full of these glistening purple blackberries. I didn't want one. We'd eaten blackberries up to that point and had been tart and sharp and quite horrid. But I took one just to be polite. And as I bit into it, it was the most perfect autumnal flavour. Nothing I'd ever tasted before. And I was thinking, well, what is this? Is it some special variety that's growing down in the cove or what? And he said, no, this is something really special. When the mist comes in and lays a layer of salt on a perfectly ripe blackberry, what you get is something that chefs can't create and money can't buy. It's a gift of time and nature. And for me, that's what the Coast Path gave us. It was a gift of time and nature that allowed us to rebuild ourselves.
My last question is always about music. And because I always think that music and travel, I know you weren't exactly travelling, but you were travelling. Music and travel always, to me, goes hand in hand because people have more time to listen to music. I don't know if you had any music on your journey, actually, but if you had to pick one song that reminded you of a special moment in travel, what would that song be?
Possibly. Considering where I now live and that I walk on the coastal path every day, I walk up to a bench that's on the highest point near to where I am. And there's a field behind that bench that is full of larks, skylarks, all year long. This spring, they've been nesting in that field and it is full of skylarks. So when you sit there and they all lift off, it's the most beautiful sound. It's the most incredible sound. And it would probably be a sound that we've heard throughout most of that journey. So I would probably say A Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams.
Raina and Moth, we wish you both the very best. Thank you so much for sharing your story. As for me, it's back to London this week after 6 whole weeks in Spain, and I have some truly brilliant guests lined up for you here on the Big Travel Podcast.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.